Hello and welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. Tate Duryea and Ryan Gibson. How you doing? 2026. I think this is the first time we've spoken in 2026, even though this episode was recorded a few weeks ago. How you doing, Ryan?
I'm doing good. I'm learning how to fly new airplanes. I'm flying Super Cubs and J3s. And
God, I'm jealous. Where are you finding all this extra time, man? I'm running around on the East Coast looking at new projects, and I got to build my team.
Oh, I've got my fair share of that. I've actually been working weekends to kind of catch up and then doing some fun stuff during the week. But had a really fun trip to England, actually, and I went hunting.
It's fantastic. I didn't even know you were gone.
Yeah, I did a driven shoot. I don't know if anybody's done a driven shoot, but look it up. Google driven shoot. I actually went out and wore tweed. You know, so I had the suit and tie on and the proper hat and formal attire. I didn't see
fantastic.
Pictures.
No, I didn't even see pictures. All right, I want to see pictures.
Yeah, partridge and quail, you know, all the whole thing was super fun. And then I went and flew to J3 Super Cubs and did some backcountry flying down in Texas. So super fun.
So cool. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing you, next week. We're going to be doing some recording in person, so
yeah.
More to come on that. But in the meantime, we are here talking about depreciation today. What is depreciation? What is that phantom expense that can save you on taxes?
Yeah, and I know that you probably listen to our show and you know what cost seg and bonus depreciation is, or maybe you just picked this up for the first time and you're like, oh, I don't even know what that is. Great. Both of you are in the right spot because you're going to hear things in this episode that you haven't heard before. You're going to hear some nuance to the tax code that you're going to be like, oh, I didn't realize that when the property sold, I didn't realize it was recaptured that way or some nuance. So I think I love this episode because it gives us something for somebody who's never heard about this before and why you should know about it, and how it can save you big on taxes.
Yep.
And for someone who has known about this, you're going to learn about a bunch of new content.
So with that, let's get to the show.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Brendan Hall, thanks so much for joining us back on the show. How you been?
Good, man. Thanks for having me back. I appreciate it. I'm excited to be here.
It's good fun. So I think a lot of business owners and real estate investors and, you know, sophisticated investors are thinking about depreciation, right? And today we wanted to bring you back on to talk about what is depreciation? What is how does the IRS allow it? Why does the IRS allow you to depreciate real estate, which typically goes up in value? But before we get there, for anybody that doesn't know your background, do you want to give us a few minutes of who you are, where you came from? Because this is your second time on the show, but I'd love to hear it once more. We have a lot of new listeners. Sure.
Yeah, so my name is Brandon. I run a CPA firm called Hall CPA, aka the Real Estate CPA. Been doing this since, I think, 2016. Prior to that, I worked at EY, Ernst & Young, and PricewaterhouseCoopers, two big four firms. Got into real estate because I wanted to escape the corporate grind, and through that process, found that there were a lot of landlords on bigger pockets at the time asking tax questions. That's kind of how I fell into building this CPA firm. Today, we have, I think, around 1,100 or 1,200 clients across the United States. Everybody is investing. All of our clients invest in real estate in some capacity. We've got, new real estate investors that are buying their first rental. And then we have really sophisticated investors. We have real estate funds and syndicates that we support now. So we really kind of see everything. We work with clients in every state. I've got a team of probably, over 100 at this point, 55 or so based in the U.S., another 45 to 50 offshore between India and the Philippines, helping us with some back office data entry type stuff. It's been a fun build, that's for sure. It's cool because through this process, I have been able to hire people that are way smarter than me.
Right.
And so I've been able to go out to the market and say, hey, I've got these great, talented people. We only work with real estate investors. We are experts at this. Let us work with you. And it's been a really nice thing that we've built here. So that's a quick background on me.
Incredible. Well, I work with your firm in terms of tax strategy. Been working with Nathan Soso, who's on your team for quite a while now. It's been fantastic. Yeah. And what about the real estate journey? You know, actually, we haven't really dug into this on the show. So I'd love to hear, what was your real estate background. Did you end up buying all that real estate that you set out to?
I did. Yeah. Yeah. So, gosh, this is like throwing it way back. So I think it was 2015. I was working at Ernst & Young. I had found Bigger Pockets because I was trying to buy a 3-unit property. And so I was trying to figure out, like, is this a good idea? And I ended up buying the 3-unit property, and it cash flowed, I think, $700 a month, or maybe it's like $500 a month at the time. And I remember sitting down and building out this like model on my spreadsheets of how long would it take me to leave the corporate world and how much capital do I need to do that? And really what I was trying to model is, okay, if I've got $500 a month in income, how much do I need to replace my income? And it turned out that it was going to take like a decade. And I'm just a very impatient person. So I was like, this is not going to work for me. But through that process, I had on Bigger Pockets, I was asking questions about real estate. And that's where I saw people asking tax questions. I was like, okay, I'll just start answering these tax questions. So that's kind of how it all snowballed. But today I did just sell that 3-unit property this year. So that's the first time I've actually sold one of my holdings. Yep. But I've got, or the second time I've sold one of my holdings. I think I've got 22 units now. I've got 10 duplexes. I've got a single family home, and then I have a short-term rental remaining in my portfolio. We'll probably start divesting just because, like, I bought all pre-COVID, so there's just a ton of the equity that's built in that I need to reallocate. But yeah, a decent sized portfolio.
It's worth asking now that you're more of a sophisticated and savvy investor, business owner. You know, I'm kind of in the same boat where I'm starting to divest in of some of these small physical real estate assets that I accumulated during the early stages of my career. What are you looking to reallocate into, just out of curiosity?
Commercial real estate, for sure. Yeah. Not even like specific asset classes. I think I'd stay away from like strip malls, things like that. But our most successful clients, like the clients that are at the very end of their journey or close to the end of their journey, they've been doing this for decades, that have huge portfolios and have small teams that manage those huge portfolios, they are investing in like office space, industrial, warehouse type assets. That's I think what I'd kind of be looking. Medical offices is another one. Those are the three that I'd really be looking into, just seeing what they've been able to do. But they become experts at them, and that's the thing. Like, I don't know anything about those asset classes aside from talking to them about it and seeing the financials and the tax returns,
right?
Which is good. I think it will help. But seeing them, knowing their stories that and how they chipped away at it for, you know, three decades, and seeing what the outcome of that is, it's very compelling.
Absolutely. Well, that's great to hear, because I mean, I think that's kind of the typical real estate investor's journey, right? They read Rich Dad Poor Dad. They start buying some single family homes. They realize that doesn't scale, because if they buy 10 homes, then they've got 10 water heaters that can break and 10 roofs and all these things. And then there's this natural progression into commercial real estate, and oftentimes a progression into investing as an LP, because like you said, you might not have the expertise in industrial, but somebody else does, and you can take, you know, 70-80% of the proceeds for doing none of the work. So in any case, that's very interesting. Thanks for sharing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, let's get into the depreciation piece. You know, we have a lot of new listeners out there, so shout out to the OGs, but also welcome if you're new to the show. We wanted to kind of bring this episode back down to ground level and provide some base level education in terms of what is depreciation, because I think this is it's a fundamental topic when you are investing in real estate, understanding tax benefits. So, Brandon, let's talk about it first in the context of a business, because then I think it'll make more sense when we layer on, okay, how does it work in real estate? So in the context of, let's say, you know, the lemonade stand, right? How does depreciation work, and what is it?
So depreciation is essentially a mechanism to track the deterioration of your asset over time. So when you buy a property, you're buying all the components that go inside of the property. So you're not just buying the building, you're buying the windows, and you're buying the flooring and the cabinetry and all that type of stuff. And all of those things fall apart over time, even though, and where people get confused is they go, well, my asset value increases though, so why would I depreciate it? But you have to understand that while true, the asset value does increase, land is scarce, and over time, more demand increases the asset price. but it's also true that your roof is literally falling apart, right? So depreciation is an expense that landlords get to claim, meant to track that deterioration over time. So it's trying to put like a number on it. And it's like largely made up. Like, right. I mean, like these schedules were made a long time ago and they don't really hold much water today. But regardless, it is how we calculate the annual depreciation expense.
And going back, I just want to make sure that everybody's up to speed on the fact that you can't depreciate, you know, your primary residence, right?
Right.
Or the car that you buy for personal use. It has to be a business asset.
Has to be a business asset placed into service for business, used for business. No shenanigans like right. I'm going to do this for a month and then move into it as my primary residence. None of that. You have to be doing this as a business. Yes.
Perfect.
So depreciation is a Vantam expense. And what that means is I get to claim this expense every single year, even though I'm not paying for it every single year. So if I buy a property for $1 million cash, the first thing I have to do is I have to figure out what is the land value. And maybe the land value is $300,000. That means that the depreciation value, the depreciable basis is $700,000. Now, I can't depreciate land because dirt does not fall apart over time, right? It doesn't deteriorate over time. So that's why you have to do that allocation, that kind of carve out. So what we're trying to figure out when I purchase a property is how much that purchase price can be allocated to the building and the structures inside the building, the components inside the building. So in this case, 700K. What I would then do is I would take $700,000 and I would divide it by 27 and a half years for residential property, 39 years for commercial property. And whatever that I can't do that math in my head right now, but whatever that spits out, that's the annual number that I get to write off on my taxes associated with this rental property. So every single year, I get to claim $700,000 divided by 27 and a half every single year. And I should say, it doesn't even matter how you finance it. I could 100% finance a property. I could go 70-30, 50-50, all cash. The calculation is still the same. Building basis divided by 27 and a half years.
Yeah. And I'm doing the math and it's $25,500 per year, just shy of that. So you could be making a profit on this property. And I know I promised we were going to, you know, use the business example first, but we're getting straight into real estate here. So, but you can be making a profit of $25,000 a year, yet your straight line depreciation, just straight line, 700 grand in structure divided by 27 and a half years provides a phantom loss of $25,500 per year that will offset it. So it's tax-free. And this is what people miss about real estate is they go, well, if real estate appreciates by 6% a year on average, 7% a year, and the stock market goes up the same, why wouldn't I just buy the S&P? Because I can get the same return over a 30-year period and not have to hassle with real estate. It's like, well, this is why. Because you get appreciation, you also get cash flow, you also get amortization, and you get depreciation. Amortization being the slow pay down of the loan over the years, right? But depreciation is the big one because it provides, you could make $25,450 a year on this property and pay no taxes on that because of your depreciation. That doesn't work with if you're buying and selling and buying and selling and buying and selling, right? You need to be a long-term holder of the asset, but we can get into that later.
Well, and you know, why should I buy real estate? I think is a really interesting conversation topic because whenever you see online these financial planners and advisors saying real estate's a terrible investment, here's why. Look at the real estate returns over the last 30 years. It's like 3.5%.
Right.
Which is true, right? But if I think about it, when you think about everything you just mentioned, the key piece here is leverage. So I buy $1 million property, it increases in value 3.5%. So $35,000 is the increase. But if I put $100,000 down on the property, then that's $35,000 of increased equity on my 100K investment. So that's a 35% increase. And I've also gotten some cash flow that depreciation offsets that I don't have to pay tax on. So that is probably another $20,000. So that's another 2% or another 20%. So like even in the first year between equity and cash flow, I'm clearing 50%+ on the money that I invested. Now, the downside is that obviously I can't just go grab that capital back. That's where it becomes challenging. It is locked up. You do have to have the risk appetite. But I always find it interesting that financial planners that are trying to be sophisticated will make the argument that real estate's a bad investment because it only appreciates 3.5%. It's like, dude, that's like, that's like the iceberg meme, you know,
where you've got
like here's the top of it. And there's like all this stuff below. Like,
absolutely.
You're just like ignoring everything.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. So I do want to kind of pivot back for a second, just talk about a business application, because I think that sometimes people can get confused when you're talking about, you know, depreciation in real estate. And I really do think that it helps to grab some fundamental knowledge from that basic idea of a business. So the example, if I may, that I always use is let's say you have a consulting business, whatever. You buy a printer for that business. The IRS says, well, Brandon, you would know, what is that, 5-year property?
Yeah.
Yeah, perfect. So the IRS says, okay, that's 5-year property. We're going to allow you to depreciate that over the course of 5 years. So you pay $100 for it. Every year you get to take a non-cash expense of $20 because at the end of it, you throw it in the trash. Now, there's a difference between an expense, a business expense, like let's say you buy fuel for a work truck. That's an expense, right? You get to take, you put $70 in the tank, you take $70 off of your, you know, as an expense, and that reduces your taxable income at the end of the year for that business. What's the difference between an expense and depreciation? How do we tell the difference when you're talking about, you know, assets? And the same thing, you know, goes for real estate, right? There are things in your rental property business that you can take as an expense. There's other things that you have to capitalize and depreciate over a specific schedule, according to the IRS.
Yeah. So technically, you can have a capitalization policy in place, and you can make your own capitalization policy as long as it's equally applied to all asset purchases. But most of our clients don't do that because they're just not large enough to worry about that. So the IRS provides a capitalization policy, and essentially anything that is less than $2,500 can be immediately expensed under the de minimis safe harbor. Anything above $2,500 needs to be capitalized and depreciated. So in your example, let's say we bought a fridge.
Yeah, that might be a bad example because the printer is $100. You just take it as an expense. Say it's a really... Yeah, but
we can think about like a fridge though, right? Like a fridge.
Right.
You know, and maybe it's like, it depends on the type of rental, right? Because you might be thinking, why would I spend more than $2,500? But maybe you've got a nice short-term rental or something that... Right. That's exactly what you do. You spend $3,000 on a fridge. That would trip that capitalization policy, and you have to capitalize and depreciate it at that point.
There we go. So what that means is that, you know, instead of being able to, and just going all the way back to rich dad, poor dad, and how businesses work, it's like a business makes $1 million, it spends $500,000, and it gets taxed on what's left. It does not work like it, like in your personal life, where you get taxed on everything and then you spend all these dollars after tax, right? So very important to recognize that when you have any sort of business, we've talked about having side hustles, you know, side businesses as pilots. We've talked about owning real estate. All of these things allow you to, you know, spend down your profits so that you're not taxed on them. And when we look at, okay, you can either expense something in year one, or you're going to be able to take that phantom non-cash expense over the depreciation schedule that's attached to it. Okay, what am I missing here? If you put yourself in the shoes of our listeners, what are they thinking about right now? What are they asking?
So they're probably asking what can be depreciated faster over a faster timeline, because we kind of just talked about that writing off 5-year property. So, you know, in our example, we said you've got $1 million acquisition price, 700K is allocated to the building, and you depreciate that over 27 and a half years. But the building is made up of components that will only last 5, 7, and 15 years. So there you can depreciate over a faster timeline, which I'm sure we'll talk about here in a second. The other big thing to know is that if your depreciation expense creates a tax loss, so it's really important to understand. Not an operating loss. We don't actually want to lose money, right?
Right.
So we want operating income, but then we want to tell the IRS we actually lost money. That's a tax loss. So on an operating basis, rents minus my real expenses, I made $10,000, but now I've got that $25,000 depreciation expense that comes into play. So I'm on my P&L, it's minus $15,000. That's a tax loss because depreciation is this phantom expense. I'm not actually outlaying cash for it every year. That's a good thing. But then the question becomes, can I use that tax loss? And then the third thing to think about is, when I sell this property, how does depreciation impact the gain on sale? And that's a really important consideration to think about too. So
absolutely.
Which of those three would you like to start talking about?
Let's get into the cost segregation study first. Okay. So let's talk about accelerating depreciation on real estate. Because normally, so we just used that example. You got $1 million property, $700,000 worth of structural value. And if we just do nothing, you're able to take $25,450 in a depreciation expense every year. But wait, there's more. Like Brandon said, you're able to grab some of these components that the IRS recognizes are not going to last 27 and a half years. You think your refrigerator is going to last almost 30 years? And in a commercial property, it's 39. So definitely not. We're able to do an engineering study and grab some of these components out and put them in their more appropriate categories. So let's talk about a cost seg.
Yeah, so cost seg is the science and potentially art of reallocating value to components that are not going to last 27 and a half or 39 years. So it's going to be the personal property items, furnitures, fixtures, pavement for your parking lots, those types of things that just simply won't last that long. So what you would do is you would pay a cost segregation firm, which we just launched one, by the way. That's fantastic. A side note. You would pay a cost segregation firm to come in and say, all right, Brandon, you bought this property for $1 million. It's now $700,000 is the building, but inside the building, there's all these components that are not going to last 27 and a half years. So we've identified that $100,000 of those components is 5-year property, $50,000 is 7-year property, and $50,000 is 15-year property. So of the $700,000 building, $200,000 of that is going to be reallocated to 5, 7, and 15-year property. And so if we just think about what this does, is it speeds up your annual depreciation expense. And let's just think about, just to make it really simple, the $100,000 of 5-year property. So instead of taking $25,000 a year on the entire 700K, for the first year, I would take, technically it's double declining balance on 5-year property. So it's actually $40,000 on the 100K. So I get $40,000 just on the 100K. And then I get money on the 7-year and the 15-year, and then also the remaining 27 and a half year value that is still there, the 500K that's left. So like the first year in this example, I'm probably taking like $80,000 of depreciation rather than $25,000 if I didn't do the cost seg study. But oh wait, there's more with
bonus depreciation.
Yeah, just to follow your spiel.
Yeah.
Bonus depreciation, it's always been a factor, but starting January, I think 19th of 2025, it's now 100% bonus depreciation again. And what that means is we can take 100% bonus depreciation, meaning we can fully expense components with a useful life of less than 20 years.
Right.
So this cost seg study that we just engaged in identified our 5, 7, and 15-year property. All of that property is less than 20 years. The value that was identified was $200,000, meaning that in the year that I acquire this property and in the year that I get this cost seg study done, I can have a $200,000 first year write-off rather than $25,000. And that is very powerful on a net present value basis.
Which, huge. And if you consider that you're leveraging the property, let's say you put 20% down, and you got a loan, and we're, you know, that's fairly highly leveraged for, say, commercial real estate, but in residential, that's standard. Let's say it's a, you know, it's a townhome, $1 million. You're putting $200,000 down, you're getting a $200,000 tax benefit. I mean, it's insane. So, and to give people background, the bonus depreciation in its current form first came out in 2017 through the Tax Cut and Jobs Act. That lasted for 5 years. It was 2017 through 2022. And then we were phasing out. We went from 100% bonus in 22 to 80% to 60% to 40. And when Trump got reelected, they just passed the big, beautiful bill, and it brought back 100% bonus depreciation permanently until someone else gets into office and writes a new tax bill, right?
Yeah. Permanently
in air quotes, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
So there's no phase out in the current tax bill. So we have this 100% bonus depreciation that we're able to use on any asset, business asset that has less than 20-year lifespan. Brandon, what's the depreciation schedule on an airplane?
It's either 5 or 7 years, but yeah, it also qualifies for 100%.
And because it's less than 20 years, right? So yes. We talk about buying and depreciating airplanes on this show. You know, you can buy a Cessna 172 and put it in a lease pool for the local flight school, and you can write off 100% of the purchase the year you bought it. And I think what's, I know we're getting a little bit off on a tangent on 100% bonus depreciation, but I think something that is unique to this iteration of bonus depreciation is that it does not require the asset to be new. It just has to be new to you. So you can buy a 1972 Cessna and it qualifies for bonus because it's new to you.
Should we get a Hall CPA Vision jet or is those like no good?
What's okay. The pilot thing? I don't know. Yeah. I think that, you know, for professional pilots, anything with a parachute is a little bit, you know, that's a lot of wasted weight.
It's a good, but, like, you know, like, you know, my wife, like, a little more comfortable.
That's right. That's right.
I like it. I'm pretty sure that's totally what it's for.
They're pretty cool. Pretty cool toys. So, okay. So we understand the general concept of depreciation here. A cost segregation study is this engineering report that pulls these components out. We can bonus them. It just juices your year one returns. That's fantastic. You know, I want to go on a little bit of a cost seg tangent with you. Let's talk about the AmeriSouth case.
Okay.
Because I think a lot of people listening to this show, we've seen on the Passive Income Pilots Facebook group that people want to do a cost seg and they're like, I found this like DIY company and I can do it myself. Can we talk a little bit about what the IRS is auditing in terms of cost segs right now, and maybe what are some of the pitfalls if somebody's doing a cost seg on their own property?
Yeah, so the IRS with the DIY studies and like the virtual studies, and so it's interesting. So the cost seg service that we just launched, we hired a big firm's cost seg director to come help us build it. And we're only doing in-person site visits. And a big part of that is because of how the IRS is attacking these cost segs right now. The AmeriSouth case, in summary, is that the taxpayer did not show up to the final court date when they actually litigated it. And so the IRS won on everything by default.
Right.
And the big piece is the millwork in the property was reclassified as structural rather than personal property. So what the IRS is essentially doing is they're saying, look, like, we won this AmeriSouth case, and therefore, if you do a DIY study, the DIYs in the virtual, my understanding is that most of the companies doing DIYs and virtual studies ignore AmeriSouth, which, you know, frankly, if you actually went all the way to tax court, you would probably have a decent chance of winning. Even though that tax court case exists, that opinion exists, the general understanding in the industry is that it's not a good case because the taxpayer didn't show up.
Right. And for reference, you know, this was a big multifamily operator. They bought this property in 2003. I mean, this is like from forever ago.
Yeah.
And the IRS audited them. They ended up in tax court. I was just talking to Nathan Sosa the other week about this. And essentially, the client stopped responding to everyone, including their own lawyers. And so the judge just went, yep, IRS, you win everything. And now there's this case law, which providing some challenges to taxpayers.
Well, it's very favorable to the IRS, right? I mean, they can unequivocally deny your allocations because of this case. And that's very challenging. And the problem with the DIYs, like the online cost seg tools, even from the large companies that I'm sure you know, they're ignoring that case. And you have to ignore that case at your own peril. Now, should you ignore that case? At the end of the day, again, it's like it's bad case law because the taxpayer never argued their side.
Right.
And it was a default win for the IRS. But again, it's still case law. And so if you are going to take the approach that AmeriSouth does not exist, you are going to be one of those people, potentially, you're taking the risk that you are the one person who's got to litigate this all the way if you want to win. Because the IRS is coming in and they're saying, you lose on this, this, and this, And then you're paying us thousands of dollars to represent you in this audit, right? Because the CostSeg people, they don't represent you in the audits. They represent you up until a certain point, and then they kick it over to the CPA firm to represent you. Okay. And so, and we'll collaborate with them, but you get to a certain point where it's a, do we agree with the IRS's reconstruction of this CostSeg study, which is negative for the taxpayer? Or do you want to pay another $20,000 to take this all the way to tax court? And this is going to take 3 years and it's going to be stressful. And most people are just like, it's already been painful enough. Let's just settle and move on. And yeah. So the IRS just keeps winning and right. winning and winning well, behind the scenes.
What we were talking about was somebody's got to take one for the team here and take this thing all the way to tax court so that we can get new case law, but nobody wants to do it. So,
well, and the other side of this too is like the conspiracy theory essentially is that the IRS would never allow that to happen anyway, because they don't want that right. case law that their default win to go away. And so they would aggressively try to settle with you at some point. And so then it would be like, well, if the IRS, like, let's say you go through the process and you really start getting serious about it and you engage that tax court process, you can settle at any point during the tax court process, right? So at some point, the IRS might just be like, all right, we'll just bite the bullet on this one and give you what you want, and then we'll move on with our lives, and we still have the AmeriSoft case
law. Now we still have the case law, yeah.
Yeah, so they can even give you everything you want. And most people will say, yeah, I'll take that, right? I don't want to deal with this anymore. So it's just, you have to be careful. You just have to be careful.
Good stuff. Okay, let's move on. So let's talk about basis. What is basis and how does taking depreciation affect your basis? And we'll get into why that matters in a minute here.
Sure. So basis is essentially your cost to acquire property, and depreciation reduces your basis over time. So again, that $1 million property we were talking about, you've got $700,000 of building basis, $300,000 of land basis. The $700,000 of building basis can be depreciated. And let's say that we took that $200,000 of bonus depreciation. Your new basis, your adjusted basis, would be $500,000 of building basis and $300,000 of land for a total of $800,000. And so that makes sense. We bought the property for $1 million. We depreciated it $200,000. So my net basis is $800,000. And here's where it gets interesting. If you sell the property for $950,000, most people would say, well, I bought it for $1 million. I sold it for $950,000. So I lost money. And now I get a tax write-off because I lost money. And then you go and you talk to your annoying accountant and they go, wait a second, your adjusted basis here is $800,000 and you sold it for $950,000. So $950,000 minus $800,000 is $150,000 gain on sale. And that gain is coming from depreciation because you took depreciation. It's not from market appreciation. And so that gain is called depreciation recapture. And that can be taxed at your ordinary tax rates. Bonus depreciation recapture is taxed at your ordinary tax rates. So that can be a very painful surprise.
Yeah. And I'd like to double tap on that because that is a new provision in the Big Beautiful Bill, right? Depreciation recapture used to be taxed at a lower rate than ordinary, potentially, right? It used to be something like 25%, something like that. And now it's at ordinary.
So straight line has always been 25%, maximum of 25%, but bonus depreciation has been ordinary rates.
Okay. Got it.
That did not change, but because everybody's now claiming bonus depreciation, they're finding out about this dichotomy, right. This nuance.
Right.
Yeah. But it's especially painful for people that like bought in competitive markets, especially in this short-term rental world. Like the Smokies, for example, we've seen people trying to liquidate their property because it became a lot more competitive as new entrants came into the market. And so the demand for their one property has faded over time. And now they're trying to sell and they're selling for a little bit less than they bought it for, but they're being shocked by the fact that they have a huge gain from depreciation.
Keep in mind, though, that these are the same people that took massive tax benefits if it's a short-term rental. You know, they forgot that they got to write off, you know, $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 off of their W-2 tax bill, you know, these years ago, right? So really, it's the IRS saying, hey, you didn't throw this asset into the trash. We allowed you to take the depreciation on it because we assumed that it was losing value over time. And if it actually did and you sold it for $800,000, all good, right? Because that's your basis. But if you sell it for more than your basis, you're going to recapture up to what you paid for it, right? And then anything above that, let's say you sold it for $1.5 million, right? Then you'd have $500,000 worth of potentially long-term capital gains if you held it for over a year, which is at a much more, favorable tax rate.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. There's somebody out there that, and I don't know this for a fact, but I would bet that there's somebody out there that bought one of those short-term rentals during the boom, the COVID boom, got their big tax write-off, bought a Ferrari, got the vanity license plate named, said bonus, and is now complaining about depreciation recapture. Guarantee you.
There we go. So remember, tax, there's no tax-free. The only way to get out of taxes is to die, right? Your kids get the step-up in basis. We can get into that. How can someone increase or decrease their basis in a property?
So you can increase your basis in a property by adding improvements. So if you if you replace the roof or the windows, or you build a new addition, you do some pretty gnarly landscaping, like all those types of things can increase the basis of the property, which would then increase what you can depreciate. And then what was the other question?
Decrease the basis, which really would just be through depreciation.
Depreciation. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, okay. Definitely. So I know there's some people out there listening to this and they're like, oh, I just did like a massive landscaping project on my rental property 2 years back. And how do I track that? Like, how do I make sure that that's my CPA knows that that needs to go into my basis on the property? Or if they just expensed it, if it was all de minimis stuff that they took an expense on, does it not get added to your basis?
So it kind of depends on the scope of the project. Landscaping is probably a bad example because it can get very complicated very fast.
Fair. How about a roof?
Yeah. Okay. A roof. So the cool thing about these properties is that, well, just properties in general, when you replace a component of the property, you can look at potentially claiming something called a partial asset disposition. And this is something that almost nobody does. Professionals, almost no CPAs do, which is bizarre to me. But and this is like another checkmark argument for why you should get a cost segregation study done, even if you don't like the bonus depreciation recapture stuff. Let's say that you buy a property, 5 years later, you have to replace the roof. The roof replacement costs you $25,000 between materials and labor. And your accountant just record, like the default way to do this in your taxes is to simply say new roof in your tax returns and $25,000 divided by 27 and a half years. And that's your new depreciation expense on an annual basis. The problem is that unless your accountant rips out the cost of the old roof and writes that off, you're now depreciating two roofs because you're depreciating right. The roof that's embedded in the building value of the original purchase price. Mm-hmm. That's still there. And you're also depreciating this new roof of $25,000. So the proper way to account for these types of bigger improvements to your property or bigger replacements is to do something called a partial asset disposition, which basically says, hey, you put a new $25,000 roof on, but the old roof no longer exists. We have to figure out what the value of the old roof was. And there's a few different ways that you can do this. So let's go identify that value. Let's say it was $12,000. I put a new roof, $25,000 on. That shows up on my balance sheet. But then I also see a subtraction of $12,500. And then I get to write that $12,500 off immediately on my taxes. And when I go to sell later, I don't have depreciation recapture on that $12,500 because I extracted that asset from my property. So it's a double whammy. But we've seen tax returns where, people have been holding assets for a long time and they're depreciating like three roofs. And they don't right. know it. They only have right. one roof, but because they never went through the process of removing that from their balance sheet, they have three roofs embedded in the cost basis of their building. Unknowing.
What's the pro and con with that? I mean, if the IRS saw that, would they not really care because you're going to end up paying more depreciation recapture later? Or would they care because you're taking too much depreciation?
No, Nate might have a different example or a different opinion on this. I've not seen a situation where the IRS cares about partial asset dispositions and like whether or not you claim them. This is purely a net present value issue for the investor and it's ongoing tax optimization. So what we see every once in a while is we'll see somebody come to our firm, they'll pay for our annual planning. We'll go through the whole process and then they'll say, thanks so much. I'm going to go take this back to my $800 tax preparer. The problem is that the $800 tax preparer has no idea what partial asset dispositions are. And you cost yourself over the span of a decade a lot of money because you're not extracting that tax benefit back immediately. Now, arguably, you get it at some point, minus the depreciation recapture that you'll always have to pay because you never extracted that off of your balance sheet. But the net present value hit is huge when you really start seeing like the hold periods on these types of things. And okay, if I keep that $12,500 roof embedded in there and I don't take that deduction and then I sell the property 15 years later, well, that 12.5 could have doubled like two or three times in the same span of 15 years. And that net present value hit is massive for real estate investors. So it is important to make sure that you're optimizing your balance sheet, your asset schedule on an ongoing basis, an annual basis at a minimum.
If somebody doesn't have a balance sheet, doesn't have an asset schedule, what would you say to them? How do they fix that?
I would say that you are being a, it's funny because we actually have this conversation internally. My viewpoint on it is that you are playing a sophisticated game, but you're not stepping up and being sophisticated yourself. Like if you're unwilling to do proper accounting, but you're investing in real estate, again, you're playing a sophisticated game, but you're not being sophisticated. And that will cost you. Now, I also say that and fully am aware that I am my own worst client. But I'll wait until the next year to do all of my books and records. And I get it. Like Hall CPA, I'm doing that accounting on a daily basis. I know exactly right where I am and all my numbers every single day. Everything's tied out perfectly. My 22 units real estate portfolio, I'll just let that ride until October next year when I file my taxes in October of next year. And what we do is we check our bank balance, right? As long as bank balance is going up, we look at the property management report, nothing stands out, we're fine. I'm not going to do the crazy accounting. So I get it. But if you're not going to treat it in a sophisticated way, you're going to miss out. And I can do that because I know what I'm doing and I know what I'm looking for. And I know that I can retroactively hammer this out. But a lot of our clients don't, and they don't know what questions to ask. They don't know what documents to keep, and you end up missing things. So I would just say, if you don't have an asset schedule, if you don't have a balance sheet, you should create one. You should use proper accounting methods, real accounting software. Yes, it will cost you some money, but again, you're playing a more sophisticated game, and you need to level up your own sophistication. And if you are raising capital from somebody else and you're not willing to, I mean, it's crazy. We went back in 2019, 2020, 2021. It was like the peak of when like the syndication gurus were like teaching everybody and their mother how to do a syndication. We would get these guys come in and they'd like raise like $20 million. And they would say, well, my budget for accounting and taxes for the whole year was $2,000.
What?
You're a fiduciary, man. Like you can't do that. So I would just say, take it seriously, level it up. It's a pain, but it is a cost of doing business and it will absolutely pay off in the long run. I promise you that. It's not going to feel like it in the moment, but I promise you it pays off in the long run.
Absolutely. Well, we'll talk at the end about how to get a hold of you if you got a rental portfolio that you really want to get, buttoned up in terms of accounting and depreciable basis and all that sort of stuff. Get with Brandon and his team. Let's pivot now to disposition of assets because, we have a lot of listeners out there that may have accumulated some rental properties over the years. Whether or not they have sophisticated accounting systems for them or not, they might just be ready to get rid of them. Let's talk about some ways that you can get out of rental properties that may have appreciated in value. Let's talk about lending against them. Let's talk about 1031, and we don't need to go too deep because we're running up on time. But let's talk about what happens if you keep the asset and you pass away and your kid's getting up the step up in basis. And then, of course, ending with maybe a lazy man's 1031, meaning taking the tax hit and redeploying the capital in the same year.
Yeah. So the very first question that anybody that's looking to divest or extract capital from their portfolio, the very first question to understand is, what exactly is the goal? Like, why do you want to do this? Because the answer to that will tell you what strategies need to be deployed. For a lot of the clients, it's just, I just want access to the capital. And in that type of case, it's, well, let's figure out how to lend against the asset then. Let's figure out how to tap into the equity. we don't actually want to liquidate the property if we don't have to, because then we're creating tax events that we don't need to create. It just really hurts the tax efficiency and optimization. But if it's a, I don't want to deal with this anymore, there's options there too, but those are the options that sort of start pointing towards, okay, we got to sell the property and we got to figure out what to do with the proceeds. So it really depends on what people are trying to do, but there's a ton of different ways to approach it. Now, if we get into the, I just want to sell because I don't want to deal with this anymore, that's when we're going to look at a 1031 exchange or a lazy man 1031 exchange. If the client still is interested in real estate exposure. So a lot of times clients, as they kind of approach retirement age, they don't want to deal with the hassle anymore. And that's when this question starts popping up. Can I just start liquidating my portfolio? And again, we don't want to just liquidate because we try not to just liquidate because then it just exposes you to all sorts of tax issues. But you can liquidate and redeploy the funds into something that is way more passive for you. And that could be a syndication. It could be a real estate fund. It could be a large commercial property on a triple net lease basis.
Right.
Like a lot of times we'll have clients that have been managing small residential properties and they're just burned out. Like, well, why don't you sell the bulk of this, go buy a medical office? I promise you that's going to be a different life.
Right.
Right. So it's like, it's that type of shell game that we're helping them understand. And you can accomplish that with a 1031 exchange. So real estate to real estate can be accomplished with a 1031 exchange. There's rules related to it, which we don't have time to go into, but that's a great way to think about Monopoly. When you grew up playing Monopoly, right. You have your three greenhouses and you trade them in for one big red hotel. That's what a 1031 exchange is. It's, I'm going to sell these assets and I'm going to trade up or buy a bigger asset with the proceeds. That's kind of what you're doing there. But what we like to call and potentially coined, I don't know if we did, but potentially the lazy man 1031 exchange. Basically, the lazy man 1031 exchange says, hey, we want to do a 1031 exchange, but we don't want to be subject to all the rules of a 1031 exchange. A couple of the rules that we don't want to be subject to are the timing requirements. So when you do a 1031 exchange, you're under the gun to identify property and close on property. And if you don't, the whole 1031 exchange blows up. And that can lead to people making bad investment decisions. The other issue with 1031 exchanges is that it's only real estate to real estate. Well, sometimes you might want to sell your real estate and get into a partnership with somebody else. It doesn't necessarily have to be a syndication or a fund, but it could be a syndication or a fund, or it could just be a small partnership with some operators that you met that you want to throw capital to and you get to sit back and collect the checks. You can't do that in a 1031 exchange because you're exchanging your real estate for a partnership interest. And partnership interest is not real property. Even if the partnership owns the real property, you own the partnership interest, and that is not possible in a 1031 exchange. So what you do is something we call the lazy man 1031. You just sell your property, and in the same calendar year, you buy the replacement property, and it has to be in the same calendar year. It does not matter if one comes before the other. You could buy the replacement property in January and sell your property in October. Doesn't matter, as long as it's in the same calendar year. Because what you're going to do is that new property, you're going to get the cost seg, and you're going to bonus depreciate it. And that bonus depreciation coming out will give you a large tax write-off or tax deduction that you can effectively offset the gain on sale of the real estate that you're selling. So you effectively get to the same point that a 1031 exchange would get you to, in that you've moved your basis from property A to property B, but you didn't do a 1031 technically speaking. So we call that the lazy man 1031 exchange, and that's highly effective.
Excellent.
But the big hack is just to die.
Right. That's the way to make it tax free.
Yeah. That's the big hack.
That's why they say death and taxes.
Yeah. And now my watch has ended. I can finally rest. That's the big hack. And the reason that's the big hack is when you die, your heirs get a stepped up basis in your property. So let's say I bought that $1 million property. Not only did I bonus depreciate it, but I held on to it for 27 and a half years. So the $700,000 of building basis is now zero. The land value is still $300,000. That basis is still $300,000. But let's say the property is now worth $4 million. So if I sold the property today, it'd be $4 million sales price minus my $300,000 of land basis. So I'd have a $3.7 million gain. That would be expensive. Instead, I can just die. My heirs can inherit. I can just die. It's so simple. Just die. Nobody likes talking about this. My heirs get to inherit the $4 million property, and they could turn around and sell it tomorrow because their basis in the $4 million property is now $4 million. And so they could sell it tomorrow and pay zero taxes because their basis is stepped up from my effectively zero basis to $4 million.
Exactly.
Or they could keep renting it and start the depreciation over at $4 million and then just continue the trend. So that's an effective way to do it too. And I will say the one thing that blows this up, and we have seen this, is if I use, continuing this example, I buy this $1 million property, then I have a couple kids and I go, you know what? I want them to get a head start in life. And so the way that I'm going to give them a head start is I'm going to add them to this title. And, and so during my life, I add them to the title of this $1 million property. What you're doing there is you're actually giving a gift. And whenever you give a gift while you are alive, the person who receives your gift inherits your basis in the gift. So if I add my kids to the title when it's $1 million, they inherit the $1 million basis. And then when I die and it's $4 million, they can still sell for $4 million, but their adjusted basis at that time is probably going to be that same example we just went through, $300,000 of land basis. So they're right. Going to have to pay tax on $3.7 million of gain. We actually saw this in real life back in 2019. We had a client that this had happened to. It was like out in California. Dad added like five of the kids or something to the title back in like the 60s, ooh, held it for like 50 some years. Property's worth $12 million. They bought it for like 60K. All the kids had to pay an insane amount of taxes on the liquidation because they didn't hold and then pass to the heir. So just try not to make that mistake. I know that's what the gurus love talking about, that add your kids to the basis. Give them that's a bad tax mistake.
This is why, you know, I mean, we're talking about generational wealth here. And this is where sophisticated high net worth investors play for decades. They play for generations. They're not focused on the next 18 months, the next 24 months. Ooh, I don't know if I want to spend a few thousand dollars on tax strategy or education. I mean, this is it. This is why, you know, centimillionaires, decamillionaires play at this level. You know, they're thinking in terms of decades. So I love that advice. Thanks, Brandon.
Yeah. And the most sophisticated people that we work with just continuously put new leverage on their properties. That's how they access capital. So instead of selling a property, I'm going to get a new loan. The new loan is going to pay off the old loan and also give me a little bit of extra cash. And they just keep building.
Let's end on that note, because this is the billionaire playbook, right? You don't sell assets, you borrow against them. And for people who may be averse to using debt, and for the people out there that are like, I just want to pay off my house, I just want to be debt-free, do the Dave Ramsey thing. What do you say to that?
I would say that it's a very personal decision. I think that there's productive and unproductive debt. Productive debt is debt that gets you assets that pay you. And I think once you can wrap your mind around that and you understand the value creation formula, which is different in every market and different in every asset class, I think you start getting a lot more comfortable with it. But it's like the same, a really simple example, the $1 million property that I acquired. I've got a $700,000 loan on it. I put $300K down. It grows to $2 million. Now my loan is $650K with amortization. And I get $1 million loan. Now I'm at 50% leverage instead of 70%. So I'm safer, but I just got $1 million loan. The first 650 goes to pay off the old loan. The extra 350K comes into my pocket. Right. And I've still got a $2 million asset that's producing cash flow like a $2 million asset should.
Just don't go buy a Lamborghini with it. Go buy more real estate that produces more money.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. That's yes, that's the 100%. Key. Yes, seriously. And with your tax refunds, by the way, don't, because you will, the piper does come piping. You got to be careful. Yeah.
Okay. I want to bring this thing home, but what I think is very important, we've talked a lot about owning physical real estate, but we were talking about getting into some syndications, some funds. Let's talk about the difference between, let's say, a REIT out there, investing in that versus a GPLP structure where you're investing in as a limited partner in, let's say, a multifamily, an industrial deal, a self-storage deal, something like that. And when that operator produces those year one losses through a cost segregation bonus depreciation, how they flow through to the individual investors.
Yeah. So on the latter side, like when you invest in a syndication or a fund, those losses are going to be pushed to you personally. And then the question is, can I actually claim them? And you have to go to Section 469 of the Internal Revenue Code, which is essentially where we've built our entire business on. And that section of the Internal Revenue Code tells you whether or not you can claim losses from rental real estate. That's where you find real estate professional status, material participation, all that type of stuff. So that's like the big difference, I would say, is that when you're investing in a syndication or a fund, you're investing in a partnership. Partnerships pass through losses to all the partners. They allocate losses to all the partners. And so it's a great, highly efficient from a tax perspective way to invest in real estate. I will say, though, along those lines, sometimes we get newer investors that are investing in syndications and funds, and they come back to us confused and upset when they can't claim the tax losses. Like they'll put $100K into the fund, they'll receive an $80,000 loss on their K-1s, and then that loss is trapped.
Let's say $80,000 is pretty high. Usually you'd see on a real estate deal, usually might be at 30, 40, 50, maybe even 60%, would you say? I mean, an oil and gas fund.
Maybe recently, but with 100% bonus appreciation, we saw a lot of like 70, 80,
okay,
90. Yeah, back when 100%. Yeah.
Okay, good stuff.
But you're right with like recent, like if you're looking at last year's K-1s, that's more accurate. Yes.
Okay. So somebody comes with a anywhere 30% loss, 80% loss on their cash, and they're going, hey, how come I can't write this off against my W-2?
Yeah, because it gets trapped, right? It's a passive loss by default. And so if you're not a real estate professional and you're not materially participating in the asset, then that loss remains passive. And the problem is that your W-2 income, or like my Hall CPA income from running my business, that's considered non-passive income. And so passive losses cannot offset non-passive income. Passive losses can only offset passive income. So what happens is those losses get trapped and people get really upset about it. But I try to explain to people, like, sure, could you use the losses and really optimize your situation? 100%. But you still have a sliver of an asset that is highly tax efficient. Like this asset still produced cash flow most of the time, and you didn't pay tax on the cash flow. Yeah, you can't use your $30,000 tax loss, but let's not lose sight of the fact that we still have a slice of this asset that is appreciating in value, and we received cash flow that we didn't pay tax on today.
And if you have passive income, you can use it to offset that passive income. If you own rental properties, you can use it to offset the passive income from your rental properties. If you have other syndication deals that are throwing off passive income, you can use it to offset that. It's just that there's this wall up between passive and non-passive. And so those passive losses can only offset passive income. And I always say, all is not lost. It's never too late to start throwing money over the fence and start generating passive income. That's what we're all about on this show, right? It's like, how do we generate passive income over our careers so that then we can kick back and use our 401k as play money?
Well, and there's two more good examples of passive income too. So another example that a lot of accountants forget about is when you sell a passive activity, which a rental is a passive activity by default, when you sell a passive activity at a gain, the gain on sale is considered passive income for Section 469. So I could sell a rental at a gain and the syndication loss can offset the gain.
There we go.
Or at least be unlocked up to the extent of the gain. So that's great, right? So the passive losses give you flexibility.
And that's essentially what we're saying about doing a 1031, lazy man's 1031 into a syndication, because you can't sell a rental property and 1031 into a limited partner position in a real estate deal. But you can sell and invest in the same calendar year and effectively accomplish the same thing. So
yes. And the one last example of passive income that everybody forgets about is passive income can also be generated via business investments.
Right.
So you could totally, like, let's say partner, that you want to.
Right. It's not your business. You're just investing in someone else's.
Yeah. Let's say Brandon does go buy the Vision Jet and me and you partner on it, right? And I don't know how to fly, so I'll let you do all the operations and I'm just the passive partner guy and we actually make money from it, which I think like nobody makes money from chartering their
it's
jet.
Pretty hard.
But let's just assume we do. We make money on it. I get my share, but I didn't participate. So if I'm not participating, but I get my share of the income, that income's passive income, even though it's not real estate. And that passive income can be offset by real estate losses.
This is the game we play. It's fantastic. Thanks for showing us the rules, Brandon. This has been a blast. How do people find out more about you, your firm? Can't speak highly enough about the tax strategy side of things. So maybe give people a little bit more about the difference between, you know, filing and strategy and how they can work with you.
I appreciate that. So you can just check us out. The best place to go is therealestatecpa.com. That's our main website, www.therealestatecpa.com. We have a ton of resources on there. We've got our own podcast that a lot of people listen to. Nate's a co-host, super smart dude. Highly recommend checking that out. We've got white papers and blogs and all sorts of fun stuff there. But yeah, if you're interested in exploring our services, that's the best place to go. You can fill out a web form and our team will be in touch.
And I think we have a discount code that we'll link to in the show notes as well. If you want to work at the firm, I think it gets you a little bit of cash off your first year. So definitely check that out. Always great working with you, Brandon. Thanks so much for coming on. We'll talk to you next time.
Thanks, Tate.